The aspect of Israeli ties is increasingly tied with modernization, development, and being closer to the US. India's charge towards neoliberalism is inextricably linked with the great charge towards Hindu nationalism. This encompasses a focus on Hindu entrepreneurship and innovation and self-reliance at the cost of Muslims, and as part of a politics of reinforcing a Hindu history on the story of India. And that takes off here. Here it is India's Prime Minister, Rajiv Gandhi, who is explicitly told by American or Zionist American groups that if India wants to be close to the US, it has to reshape its policy towards Israel.
You're listening to Azad Issa, the India-Israel Alliance. This is Independent Alternative Radio. For copies of this program, call us 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or online, our website, alternativeradio.org.
In other words, the entanglements of Hindu nationalism and its delusions of grandeur and illusions of being a besieged people that we are seeing today in the expressions of both the support of Israel and the duplication of Zionist lies, barely fathomable deception is both the project of the so-called left and the right in India, and that extends decades. Today is no aberration. This is not coincidence. This is India. And to borrow from Edward Said's analogy about Israel and Zionism, this is India despite Hindu nationalism's impulse to conceal it. So where does it leave us? Where do we go from here? If the India-Israel alliance is not stopped, we are looking at India becoming the factory of Israeli weapons on the planet. This is to say, the mass producer of Israeli weapons. Via its hold on generational long levers of soft power, Delhi will disguise its illicit weapon sales under the rubric of defending democracy, religion, and civilization. But it will be expanding Israel's market to sell its methods and tactics. Israeli weapons are likely to emerge in more developing economies than ever before via New Delhi. And these will lean towards pacifying and controlling undesirable populations and nullifying democratic movements. Then there's the question of education, skills, and the labor pool. As American universities are struggling to justify their entanglements with Israel, so much so that this entanglement, even if remote, is actually a future possibility, Indian universities are helping build the next generation to help the settler state survive. This will influence how Asia is taught at American universities. It will seep into language. Criticizing India will become Hindophobia. It already has. We have to think about how Indian transnational and Hindutva organizing will see this moment, and as they often do, look to exacerbate restrictions on what is possible when talking about India or South Asia. Then there's a question of land and resources. The Indian government, too, is facilitating the takeover by oligarchic entities. Kashmir is just one place. The Adani Group already owns 70% of the Haifa port. In other words, an Indian oligarchy owns Palestinian land. India, in conjunction with Israel and the US, have been creating an ecosystem in which these countries invest in each other to such an extent that they become, if not sort of indistinguishable from each other, they are impossible to dislodge as oppressive systems. India is therefore invested in the occupation of Palestinians. Israel has become invested in the occupation of Kashmiris and the subjugation of Indian Muslims, and likewise. Likewise, the UAE, the US, are deeply entangled in all of this too. How did the world look to dislodge apartheid in South Africa? It looked to isolate it. But how do you isolate an ecosystem that encompasses capital, military prowess, labor, soft power, hard power, and a market? This might sound incredibly distressing and heartbreaking, and it should be. We are facing dark times. But this shouldn't halt our ability to push for imaginative ways to lift the boots off our necks. None of what I have described are original or unique problems. Oppressors find the sadism they yearn for in each other, while the occupied find comfort in each other's resilience and solidarity. What the genocide in Gaza did was blow the lid of all the hypocrisies of the global world order. It showed kings to be Western puppets. It showed up the wealthy as wielding little more than affluence. It showed the Western press, Western cinema, tech behemoths to be stenographers and beholden to state propaganda. It also blew the lid off India's growing authoritarianism. Whereas it would have been very tough for South Asian scholars and activists like Professor Sharma to speak about India in an academy that has largely valorized India, the road has been cleared now to speak and examine the Indian state. The lack of ambiguity saves a lot of explanation too. This moment has seen other developments. 100 years since Malcolm X, we have seen one of his dreams come to fruition. As Michael E. Sawyer said last month, South Africa's effort to take Israel to the ICJ is Malcolm's dream of a colonial entity being dragged to an international institution manifest. Now, of course, we're only at the beginning of this fight, and what's left is us to decide to what extent we want to join it and how. Thank you.
Thank you, Azad, for this. My name is Ramana. I teach in the University of British Columbia here. I want to go back to another aspect of your biography, which is you're from South Africa. And I'm curious about two things. I mean, we know what South Africa has been doing on Israel-Palestine, and its role has been commendable. What is its view on what's happening in Kashmir and on the recent war between India and Pakistan and on the longer history? If you're thinking about what spaces we can intervene in and how we might be able to move something, one of the areas where I think there's a little bit of a schism within India is in the area of foreign policy, right? The foreign policy establishment of India does not want to completely align with the United States, right? On Israel, they'd be very happy to be aligned with it, but they don't want to be in general seen as completely in alignment. And we see that, for example, when it came to the war on Ukraine, they refused to sort of sanction Russia and things like that. And India is also, and India and South Africa, are founding members of the BRICS, right? And so that's another forum where presumably there is going to be some kind of tension between a more non-aligned version of foreign policy and one that's much more in alignment with the United States and therefore with Israel and so on. So I'm just curious what you think about if there's any tension there which we might be able to exploit.
South Africa is doing a good thing by pushing this case at the ICJ. But it's low-key complicit in the genocide itself because it's sending coal to Israel. Colombia cut the coal sort of export to Israel, but South Africa hasn't. And I suspect they would like to, but the U.S. will turn us into North Korea overnight, basically. And I think that's the issue. But it's a hypocrisy nonetheless. So that's the first thing. Second thing is that South Africa has very strong ties with India, and I think they're unsure how to go forward with that. Okay, if we go back to 1946, just before India becomes a country, and the UN was actually formed at the time, one of the first issues that were raised at the UN was South Africa's racism, and it was India who brought it up, basically. Now, this is an incomplete story as well, because India, there's always half stories with India, is that it actually raised the issue of Indian people's rights in South Africa, not black people's rights. That only happened like 12 years later or something. Anyway, but that's a half story, but still, like, that starts the dialogue about this apartheid state to be, because it's signed 46, apartheid hasn't even started. Apartheid starts in 48. Now, what I mean by this is that the ANC creates very close ties as a result of that with the National Congress government, right? So these things, you know, you can't dislodge them that easily. And so there's obviously a kind of suspending of, you know, a belief regarding India, right? It's obviously they're going to sidestep India's excesses, right? I think the core of the foreign policy department in South Africa are aware of the issues in Kashmir. And I think they may be concerned about it, right? But when Pahalgam happened, for example, they put out a standard kind of condemnation. So that's just like the standard kind of discussion around, you know, the rubric of terrorism. The funny thing is that when I went to find the statement, it was taken off the website, basically. So I'm a little bit confused by that. What I'm trying, I feel as if there's some kind of tension that's developing regarding these things. But Kashmir is not important to South Africa, like Palestine is, right? That we've got to be clear about it. Now, I know I'm giving a bit of an unruly answer here, but the BRICS situation is also fascinating because when it was envisaged, like more than a decade or so ago, it was sort of spoken of as kind of like a response to the West in a way, right? And it'll be economic and political. But it's kind of another club of crazy characters also, right? You have Russia there and you have China, you have, I mean, everybody else is also there now. I forget, it's like it's expanded now, right? And so one of the things about BRICS is that they've made it very clear that they don't interfere with each other's political dramas. And that has to be explored. What do they mean by that, right? And India has pushed back regarding BRICS' sort of position on Gaza, right? They have pushed back against it, like subtly so. Modi didn't go to the main meeting on BRICS regarding Gaza. He skipped it, right? And so there is a tension that exists there. I think BRICS needs to be seen as a body that just wants to be their own type of gangster on the planet, basically, their response. And India, as you say, like correctly so, India doesn't want to put all its eggs with the US, but at the moment it seems to be doing a lot of that, because even with regards to BRICS, it said recently that it doesn't see BRICS as a kind of counter to the West, right? So there's a lot of changes that are taking place, and that's why I'm not so optimistic about BRICS as well.
I have two questions. One is about the role of international media like Al Jazeera. You see a lot of images of Palestinians being killed or bombed. How does India get exposed to these images? I mean, the general population, is Al Jazeera and other international agencies exposed by the Indian people?
On the media front, the Indian media is extremely sensitive to the Western press. So if you write for Washington Post or you write for the New York Times, for instance, they are reading those very closely. The smaller media, they're not that interested in, right? But they are sensitive to the big media, and they spend a lot of money to lobby and also to kind of interfere to interject in that space. After 2019, they did not allow international media to travel to Kashmir for several years. I think it may have just opened a little bit now because of Pahalgam, but I'm not entirely sure. So there is a lot of effort that's made into controlling the media, international media, and a lot of sensitivity towards it. But the international English-speaking media, the mainstream one, has obviously spent more time worried about China. So because, China is seen as that threat, so India kind of falls under the radar to some extent, especially like the New York Times won't cover India very closely in this regard, because it kind of mirrors U.S. foreign policy. With Narendra Modi, there has been some coverage regarding like Hindutva, Hindu nationalism. That stuff does get covered to some extent, but not anything that kind of contradicts like Western interests, basically.
My question is on practice and hope, especially hope in the youth, Indian youth. We have seen youth movements around the world, like in Africa, in USA, and we have Jewish youth, like they've joined with Jewish Voices for Peace, not in our name. Do you have similar Indian youth movements against fascism in their own country?
Yeah, there are a lot of student groups that I often speak to in different parts, whether in Hyderabad, where they're in Kerala, even New Delhi. They don't label themselves as sort of anti-fascism. They're just sort of like student groups that are mobilizing, trying to explain, trying to teach, trying to push back against things that are happening on their campuses. At this point in time, if anyone organizes on campus for Palestine, that's actually organizing against Hindutva as well, It's sort of like Kashmiris, right? There was a stage where you couldn't put up any graffiti on the walls against India, right? But you put up Kashmir, Palestine graffiti on the walls, and you're basically talking about your own condition, essentially, by doing so. Now, those graffitis have now been taken down, right? Those signs also, because people caught on after a while. But in India, like, there are things that people are talking about. Students are pushing back, right? Of course, there's an incentive, again, if you are in the sciences, you know, if you are in tech, for instance, that if you want, you have to close your eyes and get, try to get a job, right? You're going to get a job at all these big media companies or big tech companies that are all getting, like, finances from Israel or from the U.S. Like, Israel has a huge investment thing into AI and cybersecurity and startups in India. And so if you are in tech and you're in the sciences, you're being lured into it, right? But if you're in humanities, there's a lot more space for people to be, like, trying to imagine different worlds, essentially. But yes, there are a lot of groups that are doing things. It's not like stagnant or anything. People are pushing, people are trying, but people are very scared. And people, they are concerned they can be picked up at any moment, essentially. So there's a lot of times where I'm talking to someone and we're discussing something and then that person stops talking. They just disappear, right? And it's like, because they don't know if their phones are being surveilled and all of that. So it's really, like, become, that's kind of scary, essentially.
How do you go about seeing the stories or grappling with the stories of students? And how do you represent that in international media, standing against this larger force that is Hindutva?
That's an interesting question. Sometimes they find me. They reach out on social media, on Instagram especially, to ask a question. They ask for the PDF, so we have a discussion, I do some research on them, and they've got to sort of prove that they're not a spy being sent. And then we talk, basically. And I have a newsletter. Basically, I try to get these new voices to write about their experiences. So there was one piece that came out recently. It was a Palestinian student living in India, like what it's like to be a Palestinian at the moment in Delhi. Like, it's horrific, you know? Like, you working and living in a university that talks about, like, being a liberal university, and suddenly everyone has abandoned you, right? Because you're Palestinian, right? So that's one. Then there's a piece coming out, inshallah, maybe tomorrow, next week, about Chhattisgarh, right? There's a huge, we don't talk about that, right? There's a huge operation going on against the people in Chhattisgarh, you know, the indigenous people there, right? And thousands of troops going in. As everyone's talking about India and Pakistan, they're like bombing the hell out of these people, right? And so there's a piece coming from the ground regarding that. Essentially, like, in that case, someone, a Kashmiri, reached out to me to talk about what's happening in Bastar, basically. And so like, there's like weird connections going on, right, between these groups that are all, like, being oppressed, you know? There'll be someone in the US who's Dalit, who's connecting with someone in, like, an Adivasi activist in Chhattisgarh, who's connected to someone in Kashmir, and they pass the details, and they're looking for people to tell these stories. Now, the challenge is that we don't use their names, because then they're going to be screwed, basically, right? But yeah, now the difficulty is that the Western press are so outside the loop on so much of the stuff, and journalism is also under attack to such an extent. It's like dead in many ways, in which there's no time to be sitting with someone and talking and developing relationship. It's like you move from one story to the next story, you know. So there's a lot of dilemmas regarding these things, but that's sort of the process.
First of all, thank you so much for your discussion and talk. It was really enlightening. There was a lot of rhetoric of complicity and colonialism and expansion in your talk. Based on these elements, I was wondering, could the Indian government's realist state building efforts and securitization under Hindu nationalism be seen as a trend to totalitarian state building? Is this a way for India to use hard power, such as conflict with Pakistan, alliances with Israel, and the annexation of Kashmir, to mobilize its population and consolidate an illiberal democracy?
It's barely a democracy, and there's barely democracies anywhere, right? US is not a democracy either. So yeah, that has already begun, and you could say certain states are more so than others. Like certain places, UP, Haryana, these places are a lot more illiberal, if you want to call it. They're like, in a way, you can call India, like Israel is like an ethnocracy, right? It's basically just an ethnicity-driven type of place, like where one ethnic group benefits more than the other, right? I mean, it's exactly that, where you are creating a country where there's a difference between citizenship and nation. So if you're part of the nation, so you're Palestinian and you're a Palestinian citizen of Israel, you're not part of the Jewish nation, right? So if you're Muslim in India, you know, you're moving towards that. In many ways, in some states, it's already like that, where you are a citizen, but you're not part of the Hindu nation. So which means that either you got to prove yourself continuously, like become the colonel that goes to war for India, right? So as you say, like you have to, in that way, or you have to become subservient to the state continuously, and you have to hide your Muslimness or hide your difference, essentially. So yes, so that's already been mobilized. In fact, the people are doing that in many ways. The state is not coming up with a policy that says, go and hack this person or lynch this person. The state doesn't say that, right? But it's encouraging people to do so in different ways. So you have people walking through neighborhoods in certain parts where they'll be screaming genocidal chants about the people living there, the Muslims living there. The Muslims may end up throwing stones at those guys. So then they are picked up and taken to jail, basically, right? And then if the proof comes out that they were provoked into doing these kinds of things, there'll be no apology from the state, essentially, because that's going to cost them politically, right? So it's, again, it goes, so yeah, that has already happened. It's just that because India is so big, it's not happening everywhere all the time, right? And I think we have to be clear about that. But yeah, it's, for me, it's already that illiberal, and it's an ethnocracy to me, essentially.
Thank you.
You were just listening to Azad Issa on the India-Israel Alliance. He spoke in Vancouver, British Columbia. Azad Issa is an award-winning journalist and a senior reporter for Middle East Eye. This program is produced by Alternative Radio, an independent nonprofit in our 40th year. We're supported solely by individuals just like you. We feature such voices as Amy Goodman, Claudia de la Cruz, Arundhati Roy, Chris Hedges, Tariq Ali, and Vijay Prashad. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. For copies of today's program, Azad Issa on the India-Israel Alliance, and for Vijay Prashad's book, Washington Bullets, CIA Coups and Assassinations, just call us, 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or online our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org. Printed transcripts, PDFs, and MP3s of this program are free of charge. To get them, just call us, 1-800-444-1977. Special thanks to Sunset in Vancouver, B.C. Joe Rich is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamyan. Thank you for listening. With sitar maestro Vilayat Khan, raga Mian Kitori.
Forbes Avenue is a production of WRCT Pittsburgh. The opinions expressed are those of the participants and not necessarily those of WRCT, its members, or Carnegie Mellon University. Email questions or comments to pa@wrct.org.
Hello, welcome to Forbes Avenue. I'm Rihanna Duncan, and today I have Rachel Curry here with me. So specifically what I'm going to be talking about with you today is that you are a freelance journalist. So how did you go from like just an English major to actually working in news?
Yeah, so I attended the University of Delaware, and there I majored in English and minored in journalism. There was no journalism major at the school I attended, but I had the opportunity to spend some of my free time writing for the campus newspaper, specifically the lifestyle slash arts and entertainment section, which was more up my alley at the time. And it was a lot of fun, and it enabled me to, get exposed to different parts of campus life that I otherwise would not have. I also joined a literary publication club called Main Street Journal. And I know that people who are listening in aren't familiar with maybe the University of Delaware's ins and outs, but it was basically poetry, some short stories, photography, a lot of cool stuff. And I ended up being the editor-in-chief of that my senior year. And that gave me some experience just kind of putting something together and seeing a finished product, which was really rewarding. And I still have all of those books, which was really cool. Throughout my undergraduate experience, I feel like with a lot of creative people, you face older folks saying you should maybe take a little bit more of a conservative route to ensure that you're going to be financially stable in the future. And I was always balancing that. It was really difficult for me to figure out what avenue I wanted to head in. But I also know that I personally did not want to make my passion of more creative writing into a career, because I felt like it was going to drain me. So I ended up applying for a role as a copywriter right out of college, and I worked there for a year, and it gave me an opportunity to live in a new place and experience living on my own and not having the support of my community necessarily right around me, which I think was a good experience. It was also a really cool company and had a lot of interesting benefits like workout classes and things like that, pretty modern. However, I just did not feel fulfilled at the end of the day, and I ended up leaving that job after a year on good terms, but I had used that time to save up some money and ended up going traveling in Southeast Asia for about a year after that. And I did that partly because I wanted to travel with my partner, but also partly because it was like an affordable place to live and I could get some life experience before I had some like gnarly responsibilities. I also at the time had heard of this platform called Fiverr, which I'm not sure if you're aware of, but it allows you to post your services on a freelance basis and people can buy them. And I know that some people are graphic designers selling logos to companies and things like that. I was really just writing, landing pages for people, sometimes blogs for their travel blogs and websites. So I started doing that while I was traveling, and honestly, just working on a tablet with like a little Bluetooth keyboard on a train or something. And it honestly kept me going. And by the time I came back, I wasn't necessarily like thriving financially, but I had at least more money than when I left. So I did seek full-time employment upon returning, but by that point it was getting close to the pandemic and things were a little crazy in the world. So I just kept trucking, kept going at my freelancing thing. And I ended up deciding to pursue it full time. So I formed an actual business, an LLC, around that time, and decided to stop looking for full-time employment and just keep going with the freelancing. And for a while, it was a mix between local journalism with some local publications and lifestyle magazines in my area of South Central Pennsylvania, and a lot of content writing clients, which differs from journalism in that it's more branded and you've got some bias in there. You're trying to support the company that pays for it. Then I was offered the opportunity from a former professor of mine, Ben Yagoda, who is also an esteemed author. And he, while retired, was still hosting study abroad trips for journalism students from the University of Delaware. And I had attended one of his study abroads back in like 2016. He invited me to be a teacher's assistant for that trip. And despite the fact that I'm not a graduate student and never have been, I do have industry experience, at least about, I've done some travel writing and things like that. And that's what it was focusing on. It was based in Melbourne, Australia. So I went with him and did that. And teaching students the fundamentals of journalism and just getting back out there and experiencing, I guess, that idea of why I enjoyed it in college actually really inspired me to get back into it and focus less on branded content writing for companies. And it basically pushed me to make a big pivot and do more serious journalism. So for the past couple of years, that's what I've been doing. I was blessed to be able to go to Australia for this trip twice in a row, which was really exciting. And meet a couple of wonderful group of students and spend some time with them. And now, yeah, I write a lot about technology because that's always changing in the world. I write about local issues in my community and various other new subjects that land in my lap.
Awesome. So you said you write about technology. You also write about finance. You have a book about investing sustainably, apparently. How did you go from focusing on like more lifestyle content, like you were doing in college, to focusing on finance and tech?
Yeah, so as someone who's always been creative-minded, my younger self would be completely surprised to see where I am today, but I think it's a good transition. I got really interested in finance when I went all in on freelancing. And the reason why is because I realized like, oh, I have to figure out how I'm going to save for retirement. And I don't have a company who's just allowing me to put money in to a 401k and forget about it. I actually have to make sure I'm doing this on my own so that way I'm not flailing in 40 years. And that doesn't sound super exciting, but in today's media landscape, I was able to find a ton of podcasts that I would listen to just when I'm walking my dogs. There was one in particular, the early episodes of Bad with Money, which is kind of who I was at the time. And I learned literally the basics of what the heck is a stock. And moving from there, I completely transforms my mindset in like a matter of a year or so. And I'm still learning, of course. There's so much complexity to the landscape, but I ended up getting connected with a couple of investing platforms who needed blog content for their sites. And I continued to learn more through my research. And then I started doing some journalism for publications relating to the financial industry. And the cool thing about journalism is that you become an expert by talking to other experts. And so half of my job is just coming up with questions and asking questions to people who really know what they're talking about and translating that for the general public. So it's kind of a win-win for me, where I get this clip, but I also get to learn about really cool stuff that people are working on day in and day out. Now with the sustainable investing endeavor, that's just something I kind of do as a little bit of a passion project. And the reason why is because I'm always interested in bettering the world in some way. And I don't mean to sound like a martyr of any kind, but I think if we can prioritize our investments to decentralize things that we don't want to propel in the world, and instead focus on things that we think will help sustain a healthy planet and healthy people for longer, then why not do that? And you can still profit by doing so. And also with the investing for the environment stuff, I've given talks in my local community, like the neighborhood that I live in Lancaster, Pennsylvania, as a climate action committee. And I've given a talk to them, and I've given a talk to my co-working space. So it's a pretty neat opportunity to just get to know people on a different level.
Wow. What would you say are the pros and also the cons of being freelance?
This is something that I'm always thinking about. The pros, number one, is flexibility in your day-to-day schedule. I have the opportunity, I consider myself a more of a fast writer than some people might consider themselves. And because of that, I'm able to finish my work and maybe go to the gym later in the day before my partner gets home from his 9 to 5, or finish my work and I think this afternoon I'm going to go to the SPCA and like spend a couple hours with the dogs there, which is something I like to do. And that's been a huge game changer for me. And I guess I'll use this opportunity to say that the hard and fast corporate life that you think you're facing post-college isn't actually healthy for people of certain mindsets, in the sense that we all struggle with our mental health, and I think that comes first, and being able to prioritize my mental health and still make a living has been a huge game changer in my life. Now, a couple other pluses to that is that I don't have to wait for necessarily a promotion and a raise or an annual bonus in order to restructure my finances. I can upscale my clientele, whether it's writing for a larger, more nationally oriented publication like CNBC, or shifting the type of work that I do to something that I think aligns more with what I hope to achieve in the long term. With that said, most of my clients are, at this point, people I've been working with for years, but there are a few slots of available client space that I have that I am able to kind of rotate over time and shift the work I do to better align with the economy and what I hope to achieve in life. There are downsides, of course, like there are benefits that come with working for a company, literally benefits like healthcare. And right now I have to purchase that through the marketplace, even though I have a long-term partner who I own a home with, but because of the way America works, that I have to wait until I'm legally married to use his healthcare. So a lot of it is just logistics based in stuff that I can get past in life. I think that in the past, I would have said one of the downsides is that I work independently, which I like most of the time, but sometimes you want some community. But I'm very fortunate to now live in a place for the past couple of years that has a thriving co-working space and community. Like before hopping on this call with you this morning, I sat down with a group of women from my co-working space and we just chatted and caught up with each other and figured out what everyone's doing in their work and their life, and had some quiche, and it was great. Other than that, I honestly think that I worked for a company for 1 year out of college before transitioning to being self-employed, essentially, and seeing as how I've always been one to kind of buck trends and do things because I felt like they were the right thing to do, not because they were written in stone at school or something like that. It kind of makes sense that I'm here.
Yeah. So one thing that you also mentioned is that you write both for local publications and also for stuff on a much larger scale. What would you say is the difference between doing those two things?
There's a huge difference, but the fundamentals of journalism remain the same. For example, I write for my local daily, not all the time, but I used to cover municipal board meetings, which sounds riveting, I know, but it actually was a little bit interesting because I partnered on an investigative research when a township was seeking to halt library funding without informing residents. And so we were able to bring enough noise and attention to that, that they actually ended up reversing the decision because so many people made a fuss. And that was really interesting. Now, on the national level, I talk to more people from all over the world and usually about topics that are really a little bit more than you'd find in a medium-sized city like I live in. For example, stuff that's going on in Silicon Valley or stuff that relates to some sort of federal political landscape of some kind. And I think that the reason why I continue to do the local journalism and the regional journalism, it's not for the money. It's really to keep me grounded and connected with my local community, because when I'm covering, for example, I recently interviewed a new bookstore cafe owner who launched her business, and I got the opportunity to go there and sit with her and explore the space. And that's just not something you get to do for CNBC.
Yeah, that sounds like so fun. I also know that you won a 2024 Keystone Media Award for reporting on diverse businesses. Can you tell me a little about that one as well?
Yeah, so that was a surprise. I didn't know that my editor for the Berg magazine, a monthly publication out of Harrisburg, had sent in my article as part of a larger package that won that award. And it was one of those emails you receive and you're like, this feels like they didn't mean to CC me on this, which says a little bit about imposter syndrome, but that's a conversation for another day. When I eventually realized it was legitimate, I just felt like so excited, but also just really grateful that people are seeing and appreciating the work about all these really interesting, diverse businesses that are coming to the area. The particular piece that I wrote covered the grand opening of a cafe in Mechanicsburg outside of Harrisburg. And it is owned by the mother of a child with Down syndrome and is staffed completely by people with disabilities. And it was a really interesting place because they were not only prioritizing and advertising how friendly and diverse the staff is, but also just that it's a really cool place to sit and work or chat with friends, and it has great coffee and delicious food. So I enjoyed shedding light on that for sure.
How do you think, how does, say, versus reporting on businesses end up differing?
Copywriting is writing copy or words for companies' websites generally, at least in the modern age. In the past, it might have been brochures, pamphlets. There's also technical writers who write instruction manuals and all that good stuff. I personally worked for a company that required me to write landing pages for car dealerships around the country. So I knew so much about cars during that year than I ever had before. And it was actually like an interesting thing to learn about. And the cool thing about being a writer of any kind is that you get to research all kinds of stuff. You kind of become like this vortex of facts And it's a really cool party trick. But being a journalist is more balancing the size of the story with different perspectives. You're providing, hopefully, a more unbiased perspective. Obviously, there's going to be inherent bias in anything because of simply what we choose to include and who we choose to interview. But the idea there is to provide a more robust piece with different angles of perspectives that tells a bit more of the full story instead of just a puff piece or like an advertisement.
So what do you think are some current trends that you've noticed as you've been working in journalism?
One interesting trend that I've noticed recently is a lot of journalists are branching off and creating their own publications. Myself included, I have a newsletter where I'm covering some business topics that I haven't been able to pitch and place elsewhere. And it's just a place for me to be a bit candid and sometimes say curse words, which I think is more my vibe. But I also know that a lot of readers are becoming disillusioned with traditional media for whatever reason that may be. For example, when recent publications have made decisions about what they're going to publish based on the opinions of the billionaires that own those publications, it pushed a lot of subscribers out. And I know that a lot of journalists took advantage of that and were able to say, hey, you can sign up to my weekly or monthly newsletter and it comes right to your inbox. Maybe there's a payment or a subscription. Maybe there's tiers. Maybe it's based on ads. Maybe it's based on donations even. But generally, people are really intrigued and excited by, it seems, kind of grassroots journalism right now. I know that I just subscribed to a newsletter that is written by people in prison and gives us a perspective of a world that we often only hear about from the outside. And I'm looking forward to receiving my first edition of that to see what that's all about. There's also another publication I'm part of called More to Her Story, which talks about the trials and tribulations of people, women specifically, around the world, oftentimes refugees or people in third world countries who are struggling to even gain an education. And I think it's cool to follow these more niche publications because it gives us a deeper dive into those perspectives. And another thing that's changing with journalism, I will say that there is another kind of hesitancy with the media that is approaching the more we get into this new administration, and I'm not really sure where that's going to head. For example, I know publications like Politico have recently been evicted from their post in the Pentagon and replaced with, for example, Breitbart News. And I think that does scare people a little. It scares me, I'll be honest, but I'm looking forward to seeing where the journalists are able to finagle their way through and get the details about what's going on in our country.
Uh-huh. Well, you said that a lot of journalists now have newsletters. Do you think this is kind of a response to the fact that like smaller publications have been on a decline for the past 20 years or so?
I think that it's not necessarily a response to that, but more of a rewriting of where media is headed. For example, most of, I don't know the exact percentage, but most of the local daily newspapers in the United States are owned by Gannett or Gannett. I'm not sure how it's pronounced, but it's Australian-owned media corporation, and it really has taken away the independence of a lot of these publications. And naturally, in the digital age, paper readership is down. That's just going to be the case. And that's okay, because there are so many avenues to get information to people digitally. A lot of people do still really want to read the written word, even if it's online, myself included. There's also a whole cohort of people who are voraciously consuming podcasts, also myself included. I'm not sure, maybe I need to spend more time in quiet or something, but I like to consume media a lot. Then there's the people who are consuming news from oftentimes reputable reporters on TikTok. And this is just the nature of the modern age. I think that certain publications are slowly but surely coming around to that. Like, I know that the New York Times is creating more of a digital ecosystem than it ever has before. And when you subscribe to the New York Times, you get access to bonus podcasts on Spotify and things like that. So in one way, it's just the natural order of things. And I think it's pretty cool that reporters are kind of scaling down, being more independent, and really taking the power back into their own hands.
Yeah. What's one thing that you're most proud of what you've reported on?
Well, I recently published an article on CNBC that focuses on how digital hiring assessments that people often have to take in order to even get to an interview stage in a company are largely not accessible for people with disabilities, despite the fact that many of them say they are. And I was able to speak to people with various disabilities, people who consult on this issue, people who research this issue, and figure out maybe what the next step is and why we need to restructure the digital hiring process. The interesting thing about that is that the Americans with Disabilities Act this year will be 30 years old. It wasn't until the last couple of decades that we've been living vastly online, and hiring online is even more recent. So a lot of these problems that people face who have disabilities are actually newer, even though there is accessibility in a lot more ways than we maybe have known in the past. There's kind of new ways that we have to fight against bias as well.
That's so interesting. So what is the advice that you'd give to a young person, maybe someone in college like me, who might be interested in going into journalism?
My advice is that even if you feel like you don't have the expertise to be reporting on something, just go for it anyway and ask a lot of questions. People get really excited when they're given the opportunity to answer questions, even if they might not seem like it at first. All you have to do is say, "I'm a reporter, can I ask you some questions for such and such?" Usually they let their guard down pretty quickly, even if there is a hesitancy at first, and it ends up working out really well. I would say, don't be afraid to push the status quo and ask the hard questions. I feel like a lot of the advice I'm giving is just don't be afraid. But despite the fact that the college experience gives you an opportunity to step outside of the box and try new things, there are ways that that opportunity may also try to confine you to pursue a certain path. And you really don't have to do that path if you don't want to. You can choose your own. And there's more options now than ever. You can work fully online. You can work remote from a post in Bali if you want. You don't have to do that forever, but I think it's, you know, after college, it's always a good time to try something like that. So I'll just say, you know, feel free to connect with me on LinkedIn. My name is Rachel Curry. I'm pretty active on there. I do have my newsletter called Acronym, which I'll be posting about all the time. And if you feel like you have a lead for a story, feel free to send me a message.
Thank you. So this has been Forbes Avenue on WRCT Pittsburgh. I'm Rihanna Duncan, and I've been interviewing Rachel Curry. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
Welcome back. You're listening to Garage Radio. My name's Joe, and well, hope you're having a good night. I've got a lot of great music lined up for you, so make sure you stick around. I have some Patti Smith on the way, but up first, we'll be taking a listen to a group called Woody Carr and the El Caminos with their song, My Woman. Keep it tuned in here, Garage Radio.
To the stratosphere and check out the planet and take you down deep. Where